In this hour, we're talking about how technology is changing poetry, giving it new forms and new styles. But you know, that's always been the case. Poetry is alive. It's always been evolving. The celebrated poet Edward Hirsch says the history of poetry is the history of poetic forms. And to prove it, he wrote a 700-page compendium called A Poet's Glossary. Steve Paulson wanted to know why.
You know, I wanted to show that the range of poetry is tremendous and surprising, and it continued to surprise me. There's never been a culture without poetry, and that there has to be a reason for that. And now I've tried to prove it.
Well, you describe it as having something of the madness of a Borgesian encyclopedia.
It's a little wacky to try and, you know, put together all the terms from all the countries. It's impossible. You can't actually do it. So you're just picking and choosing. I mean, everything I think that you'd want to know in English and American terminology for poetry is there, but there's also stuff from all over the world. And since every poetry has a vocabulary, you can't possibly include all of it. And that's where the madness comes in. On the other hand, I just found it so stimulating to think about what they were doing in Scandinavia and what the poets of the Tang Dynasty were doing and what the oral poets of Africa or West Africa have been doing and what shamans are doing and how shamans connect to what other oral poets and written poets are doing. And so I just found it very stimulating to put together the high and the low, the written and the oral, the folk and the elite forms and bring them into kind of sense of this is the range of poetic achievement.
Now, one thing we should mention is that the way you've constructed your poet's glossary is it's arranged alphabetically. So we should actually start at the beginning here. Your very first entry is the word, I don't know if I'm saying this right, abecedarian? Abecedarian?
Yes, that's it.
Okay, what does that mean?
It's an alphabetical acrostic in which each line or stanza begins with a successive letter of the alphabet. So you begin, the first line begins with A. The second line begins with B, the third line begins with C, like that. And it turns out that this form, it's the alphabet plus the suffix arius, is a very ancient form and has often been employed for sacred works. So, for example, there are a lot of acrostics in the Hebrew Bible that are alphabetical. So Psalm 119 consists of 22 8-line stanzas, one for each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. I think that's interesting that poets, often in religious traditions, felt the need to organize their poems or their prayers in alphabetical order and follow the structure of this form.
You know, I can imagine the response that you get from a lot of contemporary poets today is that sure sounds restrictive to have to follow this kind of form. What's the point? Why work within this kind of ancient tradition where there are so many rules, frankly?
It's true that many poets rebel against the forms, the traditional forms, and they are restrictive, but of course the forms are also liberating.
Now, we've mentioned that your poet's glossary is a monster of a book. I mean, over 700 pages long, and, you know, it covers everything. Do you have favorite entries or favorite discoveries as you were doing all this research?
Yes, I have many of them. For example, I'd never heard of something called drum poetry, which just absolutely blew my mind. There are villages in Africa where you've heard of talking drums.
Right.
Where people speak to each other through the drums.
Which can carry miles, and that's a way of fast communication.
So I would drum something to you, and you would hear it, and then, you know, 10 minutes later, you'd come with my lunch or, you know, with something else, maybe more unpleasant. But drum poetry, a form of this, is that I would signal to you something, but it's expressive. It's not just instrumental. In the sense that it's not just telling you to do something practical, it's a kind of way of expressing something. And it's understood as a kind of language.
You're talking about actual drumming? I mean, this is drumming, this is not words, but you're saying this is a form of poetry.
That's right. It's thought of as a form of poetry because it's thought of not just as music, but as a form of language. So that was amazing to me. One of the things I found was that was a surprise to me was there are many forms of poetic insults in which one poet insults another poet and the poet comes back. And one of these forms that I found especially stimulating was a Scottish form of flyting.
Flyting?
And flyting, F-L-Y-T-I-N-G.
Okay.
It's a Scottish word. Really, it's too racy to read on the radio.
I'm going to look at this as soon as we
exactly.
get off.
Well, later. One poet scandalously insults another, and then another poet comes back and insults him, a little bit like the African-American game of the dozens, where one person insults the other in rhyme, and then the other insults the next until someone breaks down. The troubadours had a form of this kind of poetic contest, and one of the things that was stimulating about it is that someone would write something, and then someone else would respond, but in the same form. And so poetry becomes a kind of form of dueling. And there are a lot of oral poetries where there's poetic dueling or contests. So I found that surprising or stimulating.
Now, I want to follow up on something you mentioned earlier, that how the restrictive forms of certain types of poetry can actually be liberating. Has that been true of your own work as a poet?
Very much so. Not entirely, but often working in a form leads you to something you wouldn't have gotten to otherwise.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. For example, the sonnet form was created by a group of notaries in Sicily in the 13th century. They were legal minds. But what they hit upon was the subject of courtly or erotic love. And what they somehow unraveled, partially accidentally, partially concretely and thinking it through, was that you could create a logical structure to try and treat an illogical subject. And I've often found that when you want to make the case, when you want to create an argument in a poem, especially a love poem, you can structure the experience and call on the history of poetry by writing a sonnet. So too, for example, a traditional form like the villanelle, a recurrent form which is song-like and may have had its roots in song, is a poem that it repeats two lines so obsessively that it's very strong for the subject of loss because it just keeps bringing it back. And so the great villanelle, say Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night or Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, are villanelles of loss. And so if you have a poem that you're trying to think through about loss, then the villanelle is there for you as a form to try and create it, structure it, articulate it, dramatize it through a traditional form.
Edward Hirsch is the author of 9 books of poetry and the long-running Poet's Choice column in the Washington Post. Steve Paulson talked with him about his 700-page Poet's Glossary.